I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. French President Macron was determined to have a more successful G7 summit this year than the one hosted by Canadian President Trudeau last year, when President Trump left in a huff after a spat with Trudeau and refused to sign the joint communique. Trump stayed this time for the three-day event with world leaders in Beirut, although there was no joint communique to sign. The Iranian foreign minister made a surprise visit, and the president made some head-scratching comments about a series of issues, including his trade war with China, wanting Russia back at the summit, and suggesting his Doral Golf Resort in Florida for the next meeting of world leaders. So now that the dust has settled, what was accomplished at the G7 this time, and what does this all say about the U.S. relationship with Europe and, frankly, the rest of the world? We asked Heather Connolly to join us. She's Senior Vice President for Europe, Eurasia, and the Arctic, Director of the Europe Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, joining us from the studios of CSIS. And Heather Connolly, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
So was this G7 summit all about managing the American president?
It was, in fact. There was so much sound and fury. I'm not sure it signified very much. We had a series of bilateral meetings, a series of contradictory statements throughout. I mean, it was a lot of entertainment value, but the outcomes, you know, driving new policies, driving significant change, that certainly was something that did not come out of the G7 summit.
In fact, Macron wanted to make inequality really the theme of the summit this year. Did that get any discussion?
It really didn't. And this is where we still sort of have one foot in how we used to conduct this type of multilateral diplomacy at the G7. And this was very much what Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau tried to do last year, sort of put this in a traditional, here's the agenda, here's the communique. It worked poorly the last time. So President Macron decided he would totally change everything up, but it didn't accomplish very much either. So they've tried different ways, but we're still not gaining traction on an agenda.
He, meaning President Macron, also made the fires in the Amazon a key issue. They came up with some money, not a lot of money, I should say. How much, and apparently there was a meeting about this that President Trump did not attend.
You're absolutely right. Certainly, President Macron has made climate change a very significant focal point of his agenda. Of course, the Paris Climate Accords, there's a lot of French ownership in getting bold climate actions forward. And of course, the Amazon fires were so urgent, and there was a discussion. But again, some of the wealthiest nations in the world, if what they come out with is a bold initiative, is $20 million, which was then very quickly declined by the Brazilian president, although there's some question now, a lot of tit and tat between France and Brazil about wives and treatment of one another.
Yeah, what's
it just
the wife
was, again,
thing?
A farce.
Yeah, what was the wife thing about?
This is it sort of gets the age of sort of, statesmanship versus the Twitter sphere. The Brazilian president evidently had used two photos to compare his wife with President Macron's wife and their ages. And it was very inappropriate. President Macron, came back very forcefully. Again, it was just absolutely not sober, mature statesmanship. And that was, again, another part of the ongoing drama, reality TV-like, of the G7 summit.
Did Macron defend his wife and her looks?
He did. And this is where both leaders are demanding apologies from the other. And, again, the Amazon burns while they're having this exchange, literally.
So if we never had another G, either 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, if we never had another one of these summits, would it matter?
I am a huge proponent of the G7. Again, it was designed, brought together in the 70s for the leaders of advanced democracies to wrestle tough geopolitical, geoeconomic problems. In the 70s, it was the oil shocks. And how do you get out of that? How do you work together? This is a unique forum to push tough solutions. But when the seven can't unify around anything, it is a less useful tool. But I will say President Trump has made these gatherings certainly much more interesting than they ever were. And I put interesting in quotes because it's not progress. It's just a lot of, fodder for personalities and particular issues.
Well, I do want to talk about what some of these other leaders are facing in their own countries. But how do these world leaders view President Trump? Do they see him as weak? Do they see him as strong? Do they see him as dangerous? Do they see him as unhinged, mercurial, crazy like a fox, a joke? I mean, how do they view him?
Well, I mean, these are leaders that have to deal with the United States of America. Many of them, nearly all of them, their security rests on a strong relationship with the U.S., and their economies really rely on a robust American economy that's leading a robust global economy. So these leaders, they don't, have the option. They have to work with the president, no matter of what party, of what personality or type. I think sort of year three of world leaders dealing with President Trump, they have now found their way through this. And you saw it on display in Biarritz. They flatter. They many times correct very gently when the president makes a misstatement or is factually incorrect. And then they try to endure it. They try to get through the meeting without harm being done. That is progress. Now, we would not see this normally as progress, but for them, getting through the G summit without massive irreparable harm, that's a good thing. But we didn't fix the trade war. We didn't resolve some of the major issues between the United States and our key allies, as well as global hotspots like North Korea, Syria, Iran. And certainly there was a bigger discussion on Russia that we can talk about, but haven't resolved Ukraine or those issues that this group is supposed to address.
I do want to get to all of that, but I'm just curious then how you see President Trump positioning America in the world. And it's clear he's not interested in a lot of these bilateral or even multilateral relationships.
Well, I think the president has made it very clear he is highly uncomfortable in a multilateral setting. He is much more comfortable dealing with leaders one-on-one bilaterally. And of course, understandably, the United States has incredible leverage in a one-on-one setting, whether it's with an ally or even potentially an adversary. It is in a multilateral setting, though, that's more difficult for the president to manage because you have to have a U.S. position. You have to work with different allies, and then you have to get that position through the process. It requires a much more sophisticated approach than we are able to do right now. So it's just missed opportunities. The president can get bilateral things done, but it's not efficient, and you can't do 190 plus bilateral relationships with the world. You have to work together with like-minded countries like the G7 to push agendas forward, and we're just not doing that.
How much it was or is the President Trump's trade dispute / war with China? How much did that overhang the G7?
It was an absolutely huge overhang because, the U.S. has imposed tariffs on every one of the countries sitting around the table. Steel and aluminum tariffs has threatened to put auto tariffs on those same countries as well. Certainly, the president's conversation with Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau was talking about getting the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement through during the president's meeting with Japanese Prime Minister Abe. They talked about early principles of a U.S.-Japan free trade agreement. So trade was, and global trade was certainly on the agenda, but there was no clear resolution. And again, this is the group, when you're trying to focus on China and trying to get China to change its economic and trading behavior and patterns, that's the group you work with to help get those objectives. But we are initiating trade wars with our allies as we're trying to counter China's trade practices and behaviors. And again, it's just a self-defeating strategy.
And I'll be picking up on the trade war with China with our second guest. Let me play a clip from the G7. President Trump wants to bring Russia back to the summit of world leaders. And here he is speaking to reporters in France on Tuesday.
Yeah, I think that Russia, we had a talk, and no vote or anything, but we had a talk about Russia. My inclination is to say yes. Some people disagree with me, some people don't. There are people that agree with me 100%, but there are some that don't. So we did have a discussion about Russia. We'll see. I think it's advantageous, but other people don't necessarily agree. Maybe at this time, I think I could say, maybe at this time, without being specific. But we'll see what happens.
Now, Heather, Russia was kicked out of the G8 at the time because of its seizure of Crimea, its invasion of Ukraine.
That is absolutely correct. The G8 went to the G7 in 2014, and it was a unanimous decision by the seven.
And I read that Macron said that he would be interested in Russia coming back in, but with conditions, and I guess resolving the crisis involving Ukraine.
You're absolutely right. Before the G7 began, President Macron actually hosted President Putin in France. They talked about a variety of issues, Syria, Iran, Ukraine. They had a little bit of a testy exchange during their press conference when President Putin was pointing to the French demonstrations the last several months, the Yellow Vests or the Gilets Jaunes movement, and they had a little bit of a back and forth there. So in some ways, President Macron was sort of a G7 light. He was talking to President Putin, but President Putin was not part of that group. And President Putin said he didn't want to be part of that group anyway. So they managed that. President Macron yesterday, in a speech before all French ambassadors globally, did suggest that it was time for Europe to rethink its relationship with Russia, because his concern was that Russia and China are working more closely together, and that is at a great disadvantage to Europe. But again, nothing has moved on Ukraine. The Russian bombing of in Syria, its use of a nerve agent in the United Kingdom, the Skripal poisoning. I mean, I don't think there was any leader that would have supported the president in welcoming back President Putin in the G7 format. Now, next year when the U.S. hosts the G7 summit, of course, the president is welcome to invite any leader he wishes. Certainly, President Macron invited the Iranian foreign minister Zarif to the G7. But I think it would be an incredibly controversial move. It would harm U.S. interests. It would harm U.S. national security. But, of course, the president can do it if he wishes next year.
And apparently is interested in doing it at his Doral Golf Resort in Florida. Heather, we're almost at a break here, but just a quick response.
So, yes, I mean, the president did certainly describe one of his resorts in Miami, Doral, as a potential hosting of the G7. Mm-hmm. When the U.S. hosts it, we do it at a variety of different places across the United States. It's at the preference of the president and the White House. But obviously, with the emoluments clause and lots of conversation about federal funding going to the president's resorts, this is going to be extremely controversial. And members of Congress have already weighed in on that issue.
I'm thinking Camp David. But nonetheless, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about the G7 with Heather Conley. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm talking with Heather Conley, director of the Europe Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She is sharing some of her thoughts and assessments about the G7 and the state of U.S.-Europe relations. You can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times with any questions or comments. Heather, let me ask you about some of the other people who attended the G7. So we've got Boris Johnson from Britain. He's got his Brexit problems, I guess, to deal with.
Angela, just got a little bigger today.
which we will get to. Angela Merkel is leaving office, and Germany is dealing with some economic problems. Trudeau from Canada, we've got Macron, my understanding, in France. He's not particularly popular. What did the G7 mean to these people?
Well, and I'll even add one more. Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte it was a complete, as we speak, they may be reformulating their government right now. So you're absolutely right. There was an enormous amount of political shifting around that G7 table. Prime Minister Trudeau faces an election in October. And, of course, Chancellor Merkel is really, you can tell, sort of waning and sort of drifting from the political stage. President Macron, he has got enormous strength as French president, but his opinion polls have really taken a hit during a lot of demonstrations. So again, democracies have to respond, obviously, to public opinion and democratic representation while they're managing all of these issues. And this is where, again, these leaders of advanced democracies have to be attuned to the fact that leaders are challenged in different ways as they're trying to work through their agenda. But again, the president's bilateral meetings, the one with Boris Johnson, he's so happy with Boris Johnson as prime minister. He continues to express his enthusiasm nearly every day in a tweet or a phone call. And we will see the Brexit. We're just fastening our Brexit seatbelts today as we really head to the 31st, which may, in fact, really disrupt the global economy. So I know the president's very enthusiastic, but I think we have to watch this very carefully and its impact on the U.S. and the global economy.
Yeah, and Boris Johnson made a critical decision. Help us understand that, Heather.
Yes. So what he did, he wrote to Queen Elizabeth requesting that the House of Commons be prorogued, which means basically, and the Queen has just approved it a few minutes ago, that Parliament will be suspended from as early as September 9th to October the 14th. This is a very drastic move. This is the longest that the Parliament has been suspended since 1945, and it's an effort to basically prevent Parliament from stopping a no-deal Brexit on October the 31st. So we're now in a full-blown constitutional crisis in the UK. Of course, they don't have a written constitution, but this is really an extraordinary step. I think we'll see a vote of no confidence very soon, and we'll be in an early election. Depends if it's before October the 31st or after October the 31st. So a very dramatic step was taken today.
When you look at all these world leaders, would you say Japan, Shinzo Abe, that they're sort of on the top of the heap?
Yes, Prime Minister Abe, I mean, certainly for stability, the longest serving Japanese leaders. But he, too, has had a challenge with President Trump, even though he is a leader that has spent an extraordinary amount of time getting to know the president, working very hard with the president, supporting the president. But it has been very difficult, particularly the president's policies on North Korea, as North Korean missiles continue to short-range missiles hit the Sea of Japan. And, of course, this U.S.-Japan trade agreement, while very positive, is actually going to be very much like if the U.S. would have signed the Trans-Pacific Partnership 2.5 years ago. We're sort of going back to what we left, but there's still the specter potentially of the president placing auto tariffs on our allies, and that would be so harmful to the Japanese economy. So, you know, he's stable of the leaders, but there's still lots of challenges.
Do you think French President Macron was trying to position himself as the leader in Europe? And I'm even curious about his asking the Iranian foreign minister Zarif to come at least for a quickie at the G7 in Beirut. What do you think that was all about?
So you're absolutely right. In some ways, President Macron is trying to step into a vacuum. The first place he's stepping into it is in Europe because the UK has taken itself out because of Brexit, of playing a larger role within Europe. As I said, Germany is undergoing a prolonged political transition. They're struggling economically. Italy, of course, is having many, many political difficulties. So he now naturally is sort of the one leader that can sort of assume that position. He sees the vacuum that the U.S. is leaving as it's removing itself from multilateral formats. And so he really wants France to play a greater role, whether that's certainly Iran. He sees the same role in Russia. He sees himself as a bridge, the unique statesman that can bridge all of these divides. He's tried to do that in Libya. Quite frankly, he's had limited success, but he is trying. You get credit for trying. But in this world, in foreign security policy, results have to matter, not just summits and hyperactivity diplomatically. You need to see results. We just haven't seen them yet.
Heather Cindy writes, it was a complete embarrassment to see the United States, to see President Trump behave like a completely disinterested leader at the G7. Seeing his empty seat at the climate change meeting spoke volumes. Agree?
Yeah, I mean, that empty chair, that whole scenario actually was quite revealing, because for me, what I struggled with the entire time with this summit was just the conflicting messages. You sort of were so disoriented. It was a hard time understanding fact and truth. And so when the president of the White House came out to describe that he couldn't attend the climate discussion because he was having meetings with the Indian Prime Minister Modi and the German Chancellor, and then the photograph of they were in the meeting and his chair wasn't there, again, that spoke to the truth of the issue. And I think the only thing we can do in these very difficult global times, we have to speak truth to power. We have to deal with these issues forthrightly. And there was so much confusion and double speaking. It was just extremely disorienting. And that doesn't help us further American prosperity or American security. It just causes a great deal of confusion, and we didn't see very many results during the G7 summit.
Final question. Can the United States go it alone, which is something the president seems to want to do?
So, no, we can't. And, the United States has great strength, don't get me wrong, militarily and economically, and we can take unilateral steps, of course we can, in our national interest. But American power is so much more amplified. It is greater when we work with our allies and we meet those challenges. We can put sanctions on Iran, but if no one else joins us, they really don't meet anything. We can sanction North Korea, but if other allies don't join us, they don't really have that great of impact. So this is about our allies amplifying American power and its interest to protect the United States and to make us more economically prosperous. That's why we have this great alliance structure that unfortunately we have not supported and are eating away at every single day when we don't have successful summits like the G7.
Well, Heather Connelly, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times.
You're very welcome. Thank you again.
You're very welcome. And she's Senior Vice President for Europe, Eurasia, and the Arctic, Director of the Europe Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Well, as we heard, the issue that dominated the G7 summit was President Trump's trade dispute with China. Now, see if you can figure out what this policy entails. Earlier this summer, Trump increased the number of Chinese products that would be subject to American tariffs. Then he delayed the tariffs, which are taxes, until after the Christmas shopping season. China responded with more tariffs on imports from the U.S., and Trump responded by ordering American companies to leave China. At the G7, Trump seemed to suggest he was having second thoughts about increasing tariffs on China, only to have his administration say that what he was really calling for were even higher tariffs on Chinese goods. And fighting on another front, after Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell criticized his trade policy last week, Trump tweeted, "Who is our bigger enemy, Jay Powell or Chairman Xi?" By Monday, Xi was a great leader and a brilliant man. Meanwhile, there are signs that Trump's trade dispute is hurting the economy. We asked Mark Zandi to join us, as we often do, to talk about the U.S. and global economy. He's chief economist at Moody's Analytics, where he directs economic research, co-founder of economy.com. And Mark Zandi, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Marty.
So,
a lot there.
Where to start? Are we in a trade war, a trade dispute? How would you describe what's going on with America and China?
This is a trade war. Okay. We're firing back and forth at each other. You just listed the latest round of back and forth, but this has been going on now for more than a year. Actually, Actually, this all began, I don't think this is fake news, but I think the very first executive order from President Trump was to rip up the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That was the free trade deal.
Which did not include China.
Intentionally. That was the strategy for dealing with China. You know, China is behaving badly, not behaving appropriately in trade. So the strategy was the free trade deal. U.S., Pacific Rim nations excluded China. China could not join the club unless they started to play fair. But he ripped that up. That was the first thing. And so the trade war really started with that. And, of course, now it's in full swing.
Right. But it's also, it seems it's changed every day, or some of the language has changed every day, putting on the tariffs and then realizing that these are taxes that Americans would pay more for their Christmas presents or their Hanukkah presents over the holidays was withdrawn. So how much do you think that just the confusion over a trade policy is hurting the country?
I think it's significant. I think the uncertainty created by the trade war is creating havoc for businesses. You can see it in all the surveys of business sentiment. They've been nailed over the past year. You know, is it a 10% tariff? Is it 25%? Is it which products? When? You know, who are we fighting with? Is it, you know, because this is not only about China. We've been fighting with pretty much everybody, mm-hmm. anyone we have a trade deficit with. And so I think businesses can't figure out, you know, what to do. I mean, if they can't put in a spreadsheet what the numbers are going to be, they can't calculate a return on their investment, they're not going to make an investment. And in fact, we've seen that. Investment has flatlined since the war really got going a year ago. So the uncertainty created by this trade war is doing significant damage. On top of the, as you say, taxes created by the tariffs. They are taxes.
They are taxes. We should remember
plain
that.
Plain and simple. American businesses and American consumers are paying this. It's a tax. And by the way, just for context, if he follows through on all of what he's threatened to date, the taxes will be over $100 billion over a period of a year. That's about $1,000 for every American household. So that's a tax increase equal to $1,000 in annual pay for a typical American.
But based on what the president says, and sometimes it's really confusing and hard to follow what his thinking is, but he seems to believe that China will pay when it comes to this imposition of tariffs, that it will hurt China. Does that happen in a trade war like that?
Well, the tariffs are paid by us.
Yes.
There's no ambiguity. There's no question. He may be confused, but we're not confused.
Okay. Well, that's
why
there's
no
here.
Confusion. This is a tax increase that American businesses and American consumers are paying. Does this hurt China? Yeah, for sure. It hurts the entire global economy. Everyone is suffering. In fact, the rest of the world is closer to recession than we are. The European economy is on recession's door, in large part because the big German economy, which is open and does a lot of trade, is really struggling with the trade war, the results of the trade war. So China is being hurt by this, but the tariffs, that is directly on us. That's hitting us in our pocketbook.
So, and this is, I'm asking you to interpret the president for us, but he has also said that trade wars are easy to win. Are they? And what is winning? What is losing? But what is winning a trade war?
Great question. Well, does it feel like it's easy to win to you?
No.
No. I mean, we've been at this now for, since he became president and really in full swing over the past year. So this feels like more like Vietnam than it does World War II. I mean, we are in a quagmire, and it doesn't feel like we're going to get out. By the way, it doesn't feel like the Chinese are going to let the president out. I mean, they're doing a calculation here. They know the next election is November of 2020, and they're probably thinking, let's just see how this all plays out. There's some probability Trump won't win, and the next president will have a different perspective on things or will want to address these issues in a different way, TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, being a good example of that. So, the Chinese are not going to let him off the hook. So this is not easy to win. In fact, I don't think it's winnable. I don't think he's going to win. Now, what would success be? Mm-hmm. I think it's not what the president thinks success would be. The president's really focused on trade deficits. You know, who do we have a trade deficit with? That's really – narrowing the trade deficit is not about fighting wars with other countries. The trade deficit is about making sure that we here at home save more, spend less, have bigger, smaller budget deficits. You know, the government is now running these huge budget deficits. So it's more on us to address the trade deficit than it is the rest of the world. But it's really about making sure that everyone plays fair and plays by the rules, doesn't engage in cyber theft or intellectual property theft, or opens up their markets to access by American companies in the same way we open up to them. And for most of the rest of the world, everyone's playing fair, pretty much. I mean, there's always disputes, but we have a dispute mechanism called the World Trade Organization. Life is functioning pretty well. Businesses are pretty happy. But in the case of China, definitely an issue. And we've been working hard to figure that out. But again, I don't think trade wars, tariff wars are going to get the president a victory.
It was Friday when the stock market took a giant tumble. I think it has worked its way back a little bit, but not entirely back. What does that tell us when the stock market just feels like the bottom falls out in one day?
It tells you that investors are very nervous about this. I mean, business people are close to panic, and investors know this and sense this. You can see it in the business sales overseas, particularly for companies that trade on the stock market. These are generally larger companies, multinational organizations that have operations all over the world. So if the rest of the world is really getting hammered and struggling, and China, I mean, most multinationals have big operations in China. Either they sell into the Chinese market or they produce what they sell in China. Lots of relationships. We're tethered at the hip with China. So if investors are selling stocks in panic, that's just a reflection of how concerned they are about the business environment and obviously the profitability of these companies.
Almost up in a break here, but China owns a lot of our debt. How does that figure into this trade war?
I think that's a separate issue. They do. My view is that the closer we're tethered at the hip with the Chinese, the better off we're all going to be because our interests are aligned. So the fact that they own our debt, I don't think that's a significant concern or issue. There has been some talk that maybe they stop buying because we have these budget deficits and we're issuing more debt. Who's going to buy the debt? Or they might start selling the Treasury securities, but I doubt it, because if they do that, it just reduces the value of all the bonds that they own. It's kind of like shooting themselves in the foot. Why would they do that? That would be kind of a nuclear option. I just don't see that happening.
And that's Mark Zandi joining us on Radio Times today. He's chief economist of Moody's Analytics. He directs their economic research, co-founder of economy.com, someone that we invite on the show every now and then to talk about the U.S. economy. And we're talking about the state of the U.S. economy in light of the trade war with China and a host of other issues as well. You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're talking about the state of the U.S. economy, talking about President Trump's latest moves in the trade war with China, some concerns about a looming recession. And again, Mark Zandi, chief economist of Moody's Analytics, is our guest. And again, you can call us 1-888-477-9499. You can talk about your pocketbook or some of these larger global issues. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Mark, let me quote from the New York Times today. Farmers' frustration with Trump grows as U.S. escalates China fight. I'll read just a couple of sentences here. More than a year into the trade dispute, sales of American soybeans, pork, wheat, and other agricultural products to China have dried up as Beijing retaliates against Mr. Trump's tariffs on Chinese imports. Lucrative contracts that farmers long relied on for a significant source of income have evaporated, with Chinese buyers looking to other nations like Brazil and Canada to get the commodities they need. That is a very troubling situation, it seems.
Yeah, it is. The farmers are on the front lines of the trade war, and this is despite the president's efforts to help them. He's got a package of $16 billion of aid. And that's being distributed to farmers to try to offset the ill effects of the trade war on the agricultural sector. But it's only gone so far, and not enough. And you know, obviously, China is a huge market for U.S. Farmers and agricultural products, and they're just getting hammered by this. The other sector that's getting nailed is manufacturing, which is there's dark irony there, right? Because the president argued that this tariff trade war was to help support manufacturers. But they're now arguably in recession, and production, manufacturing production is falling. Employment is about set to fall. And so manufacturers are getting creamed. And here's the kind of from a political angle, interesting thing. If you think about the farmers and the manufacturing sector, those are the parts of the country that supported President Trump, voted in high numbers for President Trump, Trump country. And they're the ones that are getting hammered by first and foremost. Everyone's going to start to feel this, and we're starting to feel it broadly. But they're feeling it first and most significantly.
At the same time, we have a 50-year low of unemployment. And there are apparently job openings across the economic sector. So how do you factor that in?
It's changing. The picture is starting to change. The number of open positions is still high, but it's starting to come down. Job growth is moderated pretty significantly. I'll give you a number. So last year in 2018, the economy created almost 225,000 jobs per month on average. In recent months, we're down to about 140K, which is still isn't too bad, you know, given the growth in the labor force, number of people coming into and looking for work. But if we slip a little bit more and fall below 100K per month, that's when unemployment will start to rise. Once unemployment starts to rise, that's the catalyst for recession, because that's when you and I as consumers, as people, will really start to feel it. I mean, so far, you know, consumers have kind of been oblivious to the trade war, unless you live in agricultural areas or manufacturing centers. You know, if you live in Philadelphia, probably you're going, what's this all about? I haven't really felt this. But you will if things continue to slip. And things will slip if the president continues to pursue the trade war, at least in the capricious, haphazard way that he's been pursuing it.
And consumers really drive the U.S. economy.
At the end of the day, that's the bulk of where the growth comes from.
We buy things.
Yeah. And by we buy everything we produce and lots of what everyone produces around the world. If American consumers are happy and doing their thing and spending, life goes on. The economy is going to be fine. But as soon as consumers grow more cautious, start to pull back a little bit, then that's when the problems start.
We meaning Americans, are something like 5% of the world population. So we, you know, we could sell to ourselves, but at some point, you know, you have enough iPhones and enough shoes. We need the rest of the world, it seems.
Oh, well, I mean, we benefit from our interactions with the rest of the world in multiple ways. I mean, it's, you know, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for us to be producing low value added things like textiles or apparel or toys or even furniture. That's not what, you know, because those are low paying, low skilled. We want high paying, good jobs. And that's, you know, technology, that's aerospace, that's sophisticated instrumentation, that's financial services. So you want those things, those kinds of jobs, the high-end jobs, to be here, and you want other jobs that, you know, are better suited to other economies over there. So we want this trade. It helps ensure that our standard of living will be higher. And there is no doubt that globalization and trade has benefited the economy in total. I mean, obviously, there's winners and losers, and some people have really lost in the globalization, and that goes to why President Trump has some support in all of this, because, you know, there are losers, and we have, as a nation, not been very good at helping them, you know, navigate through that.
Well, I'm thinking those people that have lost out in this more globalized economy that probably are more low-skilled, probably don't have advanced degrees.
Exactly.
How do they find footing in this economy?
Well, we as a nation have been very bad at helping those people. I mean, this might sound hackneyed, but it's obvious. I mean, we have to help those folks that lose, that don't have skills in training and education, to get them, right? I mean, we need to spend more resources as a nation in figuring out ways to help those people go up the income ladder, not go down when they get displaced by, you know, by trade. Here's the other thing I say about trade, though. We have actually lost all the jobs we're probably going to lose because of trade. That's happened. You remember that sucking sound that Ross Perot talked about with NAFTA? There was a sucking sound. He was absolutely right. It hollowed out a lot of manufacturing in the South and the Midwest. And China's entry into the WTO back in 2000, there was even more job loss as a result of China's, you know, rapid growth. But that's history. That's gone. We lost those jobs. And by the way, those jobs are never coming back, because those are, again, low value added jobs that you know, for very low skilled, and we are not going to get those jobs back. We are now benefiting. Now we're on the cusp of benefiting enormously. We're already starting to benefit from our trade with these places like China and Mexico, because they now have grown up. They have deep middle classes. They're buying the things that we produce. You know, that aerospace, the iPhones, the media, the entertainment, the financial services, the healthcare services, the logistics. That's what we do really well. In fact, we have a huge trade surplus in those services with China and the rest of the world. And so here we are. We went through all this pain and suffering to get to this place. And now we're saying stop when we're just on the cusp of enormous benefit. And by the way, there's not a whole lot of jobs in manufacturing. That's very productive. But services, it's all about jobs. You know, that you're employing people. And so we're going to create a lot of jobs if we remain open and globalized and engage with the rest of the world, not pull back from the rest of the world.
What did you make of the fact that, and we'll get to some of our callers here, the fact when the president essentially, he apparently has some ability to do this based on a 1970-something law, but the idea of ordering American companies back from China?
Bizarre. Just totally bizarre. I mean, I guess sort of you harken back to some, I think it's 1977 Emergency Act.
Yes.
You know, so you'd have to declare a national emergency. And, you know, of course, he'd be challenged in the courts if he ever tried to go down that path. I think he was just mad. You know, he lost his temper and he tweeted that out in haste. And he's kind of pulled back on that. I just don't see him going down that path. That doesn't make any – it's just bizarre. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Here's a serious question having to do with Powell, who said of the Federal Reserve, I think early last week, while monetary policy is a powerful tool that works to support consumer spending, business investment, and public confidence, it cannot provide a settled rule book for international trade. Trade policy uncertainty seems to be playing a role in the global slowdown and in weak manufacturing and capital spending in the United States. And then the president tweeted, my only question is, who is our bigger enemy, Jay Powell or Chairman Xi of China?
Wow. Man, that's just dangerous, right? I mean,
is it dangerous?
It is. I mean, one of the pillars of our economy and really of the global economy is the independence of the central bank. If the central bank, if the Federal Reserve is captured by the political process will bend monetary policy in a way to serve the short-term needs of the person who's in charge, in this case, President Trump. And that doesn't serve the economy our economy, the global economy, in the long run. And we've learned that the hard way over decades of, you know, trying to figure this out. So we need an independent Fed that is not going to be obstructed with by the political process. And the president's harsh criticisms, in my view, they're just over the top criticisms, are very dangerous in that respect. Mm.
I mean, he's looking for a scapegoat, it seems.
Well, I think he's doing a number of things. One, he's looking for who am I going to blame if things go off the rails? And two, he wants the Fed to, you know, bend to his will and lower rates to try to support the economy, given the damage that the economy is suffering at the hands of the trade war. So he's, you know, saying, I need a bailout here, you know, bail me out. The Fed, and I think at the end of the day, the Fed's, I'm sure, I don't know if you saw this, but William Dudley, who was the vice chair of the Fed, he retired not too long ago, wrote an op-ed in the Bloomberg yesterday saying, I don't think the Fed should help the president out. I wouldn't go far as to do that. I think the Fed has to stick to its script. If the economy is struggling, it has to lower interest rates and support the economy. But I just bring that up to point out that there are a lot of people at the Fed are really getting upset by what's going on and think that what the president's doing here is going to create a lot of damage.
Here's an email from Sean. Your guest said that China is a bad actor vis-a-vis the WTO, but that this turf war won't work. This bad behavior has been going on for a long time, for decades. What's been tried already and what Mark's opinion would work to change China's behavior?
Yeah, I go back to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I mean, I do think that was the strategy, and I think that would have worked. Again, that's the free trade deal with the U.S. and all Pacific Rim nations, and there are many, excluding China. China was not part of the club. And the idea was if you can't play nice in the sandbox, you're not allowed in the sandbox. And that would, in my view, get China to change its behavior so that it could satisfy the rules and become part of the free trade deal. Here's the other thing. It's not only economics. It's geopolitical. It's military. the fact that we pulled out of the TPP means that we've now pulled our interests back from Asia. At the same time, the Chinese have increased and expanded in Asia through their One Belt, One Road initiative. That is, they're now investing in all of the Southeast Asian and actually now Central Asia, all the way into Europe, roads, ports, airports, all kinds of infrastructure that are tying the rest of Asia to their economy more closely. Also, those economies are borrowing a lot from the Chinese government, so now they owe the Chinese government for a lot of the infrastructure projects. So at the same time, we've been pulling back because we ripped up TPP. The Chinese are coming right into the void. And so we are not only starting to lose economically, we're starting to lose strategically and militarily. I mean, I was just in Southeast Asia, and I was.
You can see it.
They're saying it to me. They go, "Where are you guys? You know, where are the American?" You know, they actually. It's interesting. They are very suspicious of the Chinese, right? Because there's a lot of history there between China and a lot of these other nations, and so they're very cautious and suspicious. They like Americans. They like business. They like. They like our culture. They like our business practices, and they're very upset by the fact that we're just nowhere to be seen. At the same, given the void, they're now moving towards China.
Let me throw a couple of more things. One about the impact of the tax cuts on the economy. I mean, it did balloon the debt/deficit.
Yeah, it sure did. what a waste. I mean, it was a massive tax cut. Most of the tax cut went to large corporations. You know, top marginal rate was 35%. Now it's down to 21. So just a windfall to business, mostly to higher income households. Everyone got a little bit of a tax cut, but most of it to higher income tax households. It was sold as this is going to support long-term economic growth. Well, not so. It provided a boost, a temporary juiced up stimulus, pretty straightforward kind of economic textbook. You cut everybody a check. You go out and borrow a lot of money.
Right.
You cut everyone a check. They're going to go spend some of it and you get some growth. That growth is gone. We're right back down to the growth rates that we were experiencing before the tax cut. And now, as you point out, we're left with, because we borrowed all the money to pay everyone a check, we're now $1 trillion budget deficit this year. And our debt, the nation's debt, is now rising very rapidly.
We're also dealing with something called a treasury yield curve that has inverted. Can you explain that to us and why this is important?
Okay. So really, I'm surprised you're going to ask me this. Okay. I'm just moving in my seat here.
I know the answer, but okay. I want to hear what you have to say.
Well, usually long-term interest rates are higher than short-term interest rates, right? Because if you're an investor in a bond, if you invest in a longer-term bond, you want some compensation for the risks because this is out into the future. Right. So short-term rates are – and when you have a positively shaped yield curve, long-term rates higher than short rates, that's typical. Every once in a while, historically, short rates will rise above long rates, and that's called an inverted yield curve. That's not typical. And every time that happens historically, or almost every time that's happened historically, that has – presaged a recession roughly a year and a half in advance. It's almost foolproof. In the last 50 years, it actually has been foolproof. It's gotten nailed every recession. It's never falsely predicted recession. And the intuition behind it is, you may be asking, well, why?
Yes.
The intuition is that when short-term rates rise above long-term rates, financial institutions can't make any money because they borrow a short term, then they go out and make a loan at a higher interest rate and they make money on that difference. If short rates are higher than long rates, they can't make any money. So like if you're any business, if you can't make money, you stop doing what you're doing. They stop lending. Too much credit's a problem, obviously. That's the financial crisis, the mortgage boom. Not enough credit's also a problem. That's a credit crunch. And so if credit growth slows, we don't get as much lending. The economy slows, and that's the fodder for recession.
We're almost out of time here, but does it also represent a kind of confidence or lack of confidence?
Good point. So, it's bond investors, millions of bond investors all over the world, putting their money on the line, making a bet. And they're saying, hey, look, I think this economy is not going to be too good down the road. Inflation is going to be lower as a result. Therefore, I'm willing to pay, much more for that long-term bond interest rates on the long-term bond goes down. So it's a measure of the confidence of bond investors.
Well, Mark Zandi, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times once again. And he's a chief economist of Moody's Analytics, directs the economic research, and also co-founder of economy.com. Thanks for coming in. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bill, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.